If you like Academic Agents content on this channel, sign up for a course on the Academic Agency. He's now offering Foundations of Economics. Click the link in the show description and level up your econ knowledge.
Well, hello, everyone. So I wanted to do something productive rather than watch Meghan Markle. So in the interests of doing that, I decided to come and do this stream on my top 100 economics books. I've been looking for a time to do it. And, well, I mean, it was either sitting through Markle or doing something else. So I decided to do something else. So here I am. So just to double check, this is going out live. So I'm going to make sure that people can hear me. Yep, people can hear me. So now people looking for a PDF, unfortunately, there is no PDF because the metadata of my PDF maker captures all sorts of info, and I can't figure out how to get rid of that. So you're just going to have to note down, take screen grabs of what I share on screen, or get a pen and write down my recommendations here. Okay. So this shouldn't, even though there's 100 books, I don't imagine this taking too long. So without further ado, let's carry on. Yes, it is Ant Berger. I can see you. It is live. I can see you. So I'm going to go through this list now. The reason I made this top 100 economics books is because I recently put out a reading list with 100 books on it. None of them were economics books, and there were some people saying, "Well, you know, where is my Mises and Rothbard and so on and so forth?" But it was a rather different sort of list. It had more politics and philosophy and things like that on it. So, you know, this is a separate list. As all of these books are on a separate shelf. So let's go through some of my criteria and rules then. So what is in scope and what is out of scope? Well, in scope are any books on economic theory, applied economics, economic history, and the history of economics, which is a slightly different thing from economic history. Economic history is when you're looking at a period through an economic lens, whereas the history of economics is the history of economics as a discipline. So all of those are in scope. What is out of scope is liberal or libertarian political theory, or a field called behavioral economics, you know, stuff like Richard Taylor, Nudge, Daniel Kahneman, anything like that is out of focus. You know, anything that veers into psychology, that's not really economics. So I've put that out of scope. This is 100 books on economics. Now, some people are staggered that, you know, there are 100 economics books. There are many more. There are many more than that. I've got more than 100 economics. There were plenty of books I left out here. Yeah, it depends on how into econ you are. And without further ado, let's make a start. So, oh, yes, my rules are, as with the reading list, no more than 5 books per author, must be a book I own. No more than 100 books total. So let us get going. Oh, and there's one thing more. I have structured this list. So this is not a ranked list from 100 to 1. You know, this isn't PC Gamer. This isn't BuzzFeed, folks. What this is 100 books at which I have categorized into various different bits. So there's economic theory of the classical era. There's economic theory around the turn of the 19th century, what we call the marginal turn. There's economic theory that you know, is modern. That's roughly speaking anything since 1945. There's applied economics. That's when you take that's when you look at a specific problem through an economic lens, and that problem could be anything, or you apply economics to some other question. Then there's economic history as a category on its own, the history of economics, and then there are individual authors who have 4 to 5 entries, and there are a number of those who I've put in a section on their own. Their books span across the, you know, the other categories. And then at the end, for fun, I've made my absolute top 10. That is the, you know, I have done a ranking just for the top 10. You know, what's the number one book? What's the number two book? And so on and so forth, which you can share with your friend. You know, academic agent said his number three economics book of all time was whatever I've put there. Okay, so let's make a start. So classical economics, this is, you know, stuff from the late 18th century, the early 19th century. And one word of caution when reading classical economics is that they obviously got some things wrong. You know, Adam Smith famously has got some nascent form of the labor theory of value in there. But it's still often a joy to read these books. Like, why would you want to read The Wealth of Nations? Like, it's wrong in various places. But I mean, maybe it's just me, but I love the world that Adam Smith lives in. You know, when he's talking about blacksmiths and needle makers, and just the economy of that time in itself is a lovely thing. You know, all of his world is kind of chunky and real to me. It's not abstract. It's a real living and breathing world. And to me, the best economics books make you feel what I would call the material culture of the world itself. I love that quality of the real corn, or the real work that's being done. Also, Smith makes a lot of good points, you know, outside of the stuff he gets wrong. But Wealth of Nations, even though it's the most famous book here, is probably not the best one. I really like Richard Cantillon's Essay on the Nature of Trade in General, an older book than The Wealth of Nations, which Smith probably read and ripped off, to be honest. And but anyway, Cantillon has some lovely parts where he's describing again this, you know, 18th century economy that you'd kind of want to be a part of. And there's a great moment where he talks about the decision that a tradesman, like a craftsman, like a John Smith, you know, he has to make decisions and economize with parts of his life that you wouldn't even necessarily think about as economic. Like, how much time does he devote to training a son up, or does he send his son away, or does he keep his son at home, or, you know, all these sorts of decisions he has to make. What he's really talking about is opportunity costs. You know, Cantillon is working through these sorts of things. Some of these other writers as well. I mean, Turgot is lovely to read as well. You know, he's talking about like nuts and berries and honey and all sorts of things like this. And that's why I like reading some of the classical econ, because they're working through this kind of everyday stuff that's living and breathing and real. So if I was to say, like, what's the best, like, actual economic books, you know, which don't get stuff wrong, Bastiat is very good. And Say, his mentor, Say came before Bastiat. I mean, Say is good, but I would say Bastiat has got all sorts of fantastic, like, essays and little stories and things that he tells. One of the great ones in that book there is What Is Seen and What Is Unseen. Another one is just trying to think of the different ones now. He's got one where they make a kind of they make a guild of candle makers, I want to say. That's a pretty good one. There's one where like the mayor ends up like banning Windows because it'd be good for the economy or something like that. So Bastiat's funny as well. So he's got a very good way of telling stories that you can understand readily in this kind of satirical way to teach an economic lesson. In that book I've listed there, the Essays on Political Economy, it's an old, I mean, I've got newer copies. There's a new one put up by Liberty Fund that I haven't listed, but in that one there is included an essay called What is Money, which is pretty important in the history of a particular strand of macroeconomic theory as well. So yes, these are my picks for the older economics books. I haven't listed things that have had a pernicious influence, like Malthus's Population book or Marx or Mill or anyone like that. These are just the ones that I would actually recommend reading. Smith is a bit of a slog, but I honestly think it's quite rewarding to sit down with it. All right, so next, moving on to books around the marginal turn. And I was mentioning crunchiness, you know, like the real living, breathing world of economics. And for me, Karl Menger's Principles of Economics has that in spades, like the real cargo. You can smell, you can almost smell the tobacco and the different kind of goods he's talking about. And I like that feel of Menger. It's also a really short book, which always helps. Others of these, Jevons is another, I mean, Menger, Jevons, and what's the other chap's name? Val Ra are the three guys who are typically credited with the marginal turn or the marginal revolution in economics. You know, marginal utility, as people call it. Menger didn't really use that term, but you know, for the sake of what they're credited with, it's marginal utility. Jevons is the kind of the guy who was in London, the English exponent of that. They came up with it separately from each other. And he's a really nice writer, kind of lucid writer. I learned later when I was writing Foundations of, because Jevons crops up in Foundations of Economics, obviously. But when I was writing Foundations of Logic, what I didn't know is that Jevons was also a master of logic and had written a logic textbook, which ended up being one of the core texts I use for Foundations of Logic. So that's possibly why Jevons is such a clear thinker and writer when it comes to econ as well. So what else have we got here? Frank Fetter's Principles of Economics is a really good book on, I mean, it's kind of a treatise. I've got a copy here, which is, which I had, you know, sometimes you can get the books made for you in India with a hard kind of leather cover. I had my copy of Principles of Economics made in India. It still looks quite cool though. And Fetter's good on time and he's good on interest. I mean, I would largely credit Fetter with a pure time preference theory of interest. People often think Bombervirt came up with that, but actually Bombervirt had a very his own kind of strange view on interest, which you can read a very long set of articles or even a book by Robert Murphy to learn about if you're interested. Bombervirk is also listed here. Karl Marx and the Close of His System is basically like a general BTFO of Marx. The Shorter Classics of Bombervirk is quite an interesting book. I always remember an essay in there where he's talking about the difficulty that the laborer is in, that the worker is in, what about the fact that, you know, he basically, when you get low enough, his choice is to take a wage or starve. And Bomberberg's like, yeah, probably that's right, which is a little bit strange. One of those odd moments, the realization that you come to reading Bomberberg, like he thought that the basic choice is starving or taking the lowest paid job. His masterpiece, of course, is Capital Interest, three volume work. I can't say I've read all of that. I've only read key relevant sections of Capital Interest because it's an absolute mammoth, but it really is quite a kind of a masterpiece that people still talk about to this day. Another great little book in there is Edwin Canaan's Wealth. It's a little yellow book. My version is yellow anyway, where he talks about like what is wealth? How do we think about what the economic is? Is it really the material, or is it more than that? Is it even those non-material things that we think of in life as non-economic? Aren't they also a part of wealth and well-being? So yeah, wealth is a very interesting kind of more philosophical than you'd imagine book by Canaan. I found it, I think it's a great, I mean, you know, he wrote it back in 1914, but I think it stands up today, really. There we go. And then did I have any? Oh yes. I thought Wicksteed was missing from the list. Yeah. Philip Wicksteed's The Common Sense of Political Economy, again, is I would credit that book with developing the theory of marginal productivity, which is somewhat missing in Jevons. Wicksteed was kind of a, you know, I guess a protege or a disciple of Jevons, who lectured in London, same as him. And Wicksteed again has got this lovely way of making economics real, of talking about it in a way. I mean, I always remember the bit in Jevons where in Wicksteed where he's talking about, imagine a woman down at the market. You know, she's thinking about, you know, she's got £10 in her pocket. What are all the possible things she's thinking about doing with that £10? She has to, you know, when she buys the fish at the market, she has to eliminate all those other things that she doesn't get. So he's got a wonderful way of thinking about economics. And I believe Wicksteed was a kind of classics or a literary scholar rather than an economist by trade. So possibly why he writes so well. It does happen occasionally. Moving on to modern economic theory. This is a bit of a longer list, obviously, because it encompasses, I mean, I've put Schumpeter's Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy down there. Schumpeter's a bit weird, I would say. I mean, he's chiefly somebody who's very good on the history of economics and at tracing the history of theories in economics. But in Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy, the reason why people remember that book today is for his entrepreneurial theory, you know, the creative destruction that people talk about, creative destruction. But he doesn't think of creative destruction only as a good thing. He says, well, in any time you get a shift in tech like that, it's going to put a lot of people out of work in the short term. And in the short term, those people are going to have their nose out of joint. They're going to be pissed off. They're going to be struggling to feed their families. And that's a real problem, says Schumpeter. Now, I know the typical argument against this sort of thing is like, yes, but in the long run, their labor will be reallocated to more productive ends. Okay. But in the short run, all they're hearing is learn to code. In the short run, they don't want to hear that. And Schumpeter, I think, is realistic in recognizing that that is always going to happen. And it's a real problem. And he he sees in things like this the kind of the death of it. Like he thinks capitalism cannot persist ultimately due to various forces, but that is one of the key ones. And I think that even today, libertarians and people who are for free markets, classical liberals, should go back and look at what Schumpeter was saying and take it more seriously. Don't just come up with the automatic counter of, yes, but creative destruction is good because we can reallocate labor. You can see in the way that people like Tucker Carlson are still talking today, that issue doesn't go away. And it's not, it doesn't matter how many times the argument is made, the people maintain that resentment for a very long time. Like, for example, on the Ashes of Civilization series, I've documented people from Liverpool, I documented people from all over America. And those resentments and those times where people were made unemployed are still remembered 30, 40, 50, 60 years later. People don't forget it. So it is something that I think is one of the more difficult arguments. Schumpeter was the one who really put it forward. Elsewhere on this list, James Buchanan. Now, Buchanan is mainly known for his public choice stuff, but he was an economist too. And he wrote one of the all-time best books on cost called Cost and Choice, which I make great use of in Foundations of Economics, and also transform my own thinking about cost. So that's a fantastic book. Also goes into some of the problems with neoclassical treatment of cost and how mainstream economics deals with cost. Another really good book by Buchanan is the LSE Essays on Cost, because it includes the essays by G.F. Thirlby. He's got one called The Ruler. He says, imagine you're a... He basically imagines this administrator called The Ruler, by which he means like a kind of measure, like a ruler, that you measure things with. And he shows how a kind of pure administrator can't get around the sorts of intangible costs that entrepreneurs have to deal with all the time. So a really, really interesting set of essays in that book that I will always recommend. Maybe a bit tricky to get hold of, that one. Cost and Choice should be freely available. What else have I got on here? That Walter Block book is actually with... it's actually got two authors. It's Block and... what's his name? Di Lorenzo. Thomas Di Lorenzo. And they go through public choice theory, and they point out some of the core issues with it from their kind of austero-libertarian point of view. But it's kind of interesting. Milton Friedman. Now, I haven't got his more famous books on here, Capitalism and Freedom, because I think Capitalism and Freedom has been shown. So if you take Friedman as the ultimate positivist, right? Positivism is meant to stand on whether it can accurately predict the future. Well, according to Milton Friedman, China should be a liberal democracy by now, right? It didn't happen. So I do think that China presents a serious problem to the thesis of Capitalism and Freedom. Also, some of his other books, like Free to Choose, Tyranny of the Status Quo, and so on. I think they were good for their time, but probably better ones from him, from Milton Friedman, are The Indispensable Milton Friedman, which is just kind of a collection of essays, and a book called Milton Friedman on Freedom, selections of from the collected works. Those are the ones of his I'd go to. I also didn't include his famous book on monetary theory, because I just don't agree with it. You know, the one he wrote with Schwartz, is it, back in the 50s? I didn't include that one from him, but those are the Friedman books I got more out of. And then his son has also got quite a few books, but The Machinery of Freedom from 1973 is quite a good nuts and bolts econ book, where he also kind of puts forward I believe that's the book he puts forward his ANCAP vision as well, and kind of imagines a few, like he has fun kind of imagining all the different applications that the market could play a role that the state currently does. Hopper is also on this list. There's a few lesser known Hopper books. I mean, A Theory of Socialism and Capitalism is interesting because he breaks down different types of socialism in that book. There's what he calls the socialism of conservatism, the socialism kind of Soviet style, the Russian style, but also the social democrat style socialism. And I think it's quite a good way of, you know, a lot of the time, advocates of the free market tend to default to just calling everybody a commie, right? And I think Hopper gives some nice gradations between just jumping to, you know, commie straight away. I mean, obviously, you know, from a certain point of view, everybody's a commie, but I think he gives a kind of toolkit with which to deal with the different types of socialism, and especially Hopper having, you know, grown up in Germany in the 80s and the 70s and so on, is well aware of some of the different strands. Then I will move on to who else? I think I've included Peter Butka's book, Handbook on Contemporary Austrian Economics. I've done that as a kind of one shot, without getting into it too much. Austrian economics has two strands. There's like a Mises strand, and there's a strand that Joseph Salerno calls Austropunks. And in fact, if you're into reading Mises articles, Salerno's article on Austropunks gives a very good kind of rundown. In fact, there's a whole back and forth between Butka and Salerno on Austropunkism. You know, it gets a bit feisty, gets a bit fiery. They start calling each other names and all sorts of things, which is always fun. But anyway, this Butka strand that he collects in this book here, I've given as a kind of one-stop shot on the Austropunks, because as you can imagine, my list leans more towards the Misesian end of the spectrum. Okay. Now getting on to applied economics. I mean, Zach T in the chat. Can you guys hear me? Hopefully people can hear me. Somebody said my mic is popping or something. Zach T is asking me, do you recommend majoring in economics? No, I don't. I don't. I recommend doing Foundations of Economics for £350, saving yourself the money and majoring in something else, to be honest. Okay. So getting on to applied economics now, and one of my favorite kind of books on applied econ is this one down here, The Invisible Hook by Peter T. Leeson, because takes a subject, pirates, which you imagine is kind of adventurous and swashbuckling and so on and so forth, and then he applies it like to a purely economic lens, and he breaks down how life worked in, you know, on a pirate ship and what the kind of microeconomy of the pirate ship was. And to me, this sort of thing is the most fun type of economics. So I thought Peter Leeson's The Invisible Hook is one of the more fun economics books that you can read. Some of the others, I mean, Peter Klein's The Capitalist and the Entrepreneur, I've kind of put it in this section. It's not really applied econ, I guess. It's more a theory of what they call the theory of the firm. But that's a good book on exactly how the entrepreneur and the capitalist, like, what is the function of each. And what Klein does is that, I mean, Mises has got a few passages about this in Human Action. What Klein does is he really kind of pulls out the full implications of those things and goes way beyond the very basic theory of the firm that you'll find in neoclassical economics and indeed in some of the earlier Austrians. So I think Klein is a pretty underrated guy, actually, in the current, you know, the guys who are at the Mises Institute at the moment. Klein is one of my favorite ones, to be honest. What else have I got here? The Banker's New Clothes is a pretty good book on the 2008 crisis. Antitrust and Monopoly is a classic study. In fact, if people remember my Econ Shots series, a number of the little 5-minute case studies that I did in the Econ Shots was taken from Dominic Armentano's Antitrust and Monopoly. What I've done here, I've got this. Thomas DiLorenzo did not write Defending the Undefendable. He wrote that public choice book, okay? Walter Block's Defending the Undefendable, just like The Invisible Hook, is again one of the most fun econ books ever written, because Block just goes through all of the scumbags and the lowest kind of all the black, like the drug pushers and the pimps and the prostitutes and like any seedy side of life you can imagine, like misers and guys who run gypsy cabs, all anything you can imagine. And Block kind of sets himself the task of defending it from the point of view that they're providing a service in the market. But there's some, I mean, it's just a wonderful book of applied econ. And to be honest, if you're in and around those, in and around any kind of free market circles, and you haven't read Undefending the Defendable, I wonder what you're doing, really. I've also included Roofs or Ceilings by Friedman and Stigler. Now this is a bit of a controversial book, because in it they take as read the government's right to seize property. They take as read that equality is socially desirable, for example. And I think it caused a bit of a kerfuffle when it was published by Fee back in 1946. There was a famous story where Anne Rand, went into a fit of rage and stood, you know, said what they were proposing was evil. Basically, call them commies, essentially. So, Friedman and Stigler, even from the get-go, were kind of accused of being leftist by some of the more hardcore, because they leave out any kind of question of property rights or like the ethical dimension, and they do a pure empirical value-free analysis on roofs or ceilings. Okay, it's a history of rent control. It's a look at the problem of rent control in New York. It's a classic study, and even today, like Sadiq Khan is talking about rent control. I believe some of the Democrats in America still talk about rent control. I mean, earlier on today, I published The Ashes of Civilization on New York, and I showed burnt out blocks in the South Bronx. You know, all right, well, you could say, well, one of the reasons for that is because of the certain groups who were there. But another reason, another massive factor, is the rent control system that they brought in. You know, they made it unprofitable for landlords to run blocks in various parts of New York, and it caused a massive issue. So, I would recommend rooftop ceilings to anyone who's even vaguely interested in rent control. I think that essay is I think I do have it here. It's like a tiny little pamphlet, but you could probably find that as a PDF much more simply than acquiring it, as I went to great lengths to. Anything else on this list? Oh yeah, William Stanley Jevons on the coal question. Just a awesome bit of kind of mid-Victorian industrial kind of stuff from Jevons there, which for some reason I've always loved that side of things, as I'll get into. And then another second list of applied econ books, which is Contra Krugman by Robert Murphy. I mean, a long running podcast. I had so much fun listening to Murphy and Woods back in the day on Contra Krugman. And this just collects, you know, loads of his blog posts, you know, taking apart the errors of Krugman, who's, I mean, in like libertarian circles is basically just kind of a lol cow as far as it's, I mean, he's a Nobel Prize winning economist, but he's also just a massive idiot. And I think as Trump got into the White House, he became more and more of an idiot. So I think Krugman at this point in 2021, you know, he's probably advocating, he's long lost any semblance of being a serious economist, as far as I can tell. But there are some really, really interesting kind of individual case studies on all sorts of questions, like mid-century German economy, imperial Japanese economy, you name it, 80s Japanese economy. Like, it's got a little bit of everything in that Contra Krugman book. I think it's underrated because it's just kind of big collection of blog posts. But I don't know, I find myself going back to it quite often. In there, if you remember, one of my longtime nemeses, Lord Keynes II, Lord Keynes II crops up in Contra Krugman as a reference on Paul Krugman's blog. I couldn't believe it. Paul Krugman was citing Lord Keynes II in his blog. So I've never quite worked out who Lord Keynes II is, but like, I feel like Lord Keynes too was actually like possibly a serious, like someone who's in and around known economists, because what was Krugman doing quoting him? Anyway, we also have Manco Olson's The Logic of Collective Action, a book I've shilled many times, but it's actually about how minority groups almost always get their way in a democracy, turning over the long-standing kind of classical concern that democracy is the tyranny of the majority. Actually, Manco Olson shows that the majority can never all face in the same direction at the same time, whereas minority special interest groups who are united around just one or two things can often get their own way when everybody else's head is turned. And again, it's a problem. Like, it's a big problem, and more people should pay attention to Olson. Leonard E. Reed's I Pencil, absolutely classic. You've probably seen the Milton Friedman clip, you know, holding the pencil, famous one. But it's actually from Leonard Reed's it's a long essay, really. I Pencil, or a pamphlet put out by Fee, which is all about all of the individual efforts involved in producing something as simple as a pencil, the coordinating magic of the market. Lawrence W. Reed's Excuse Me, Professor is another book I've shown quite a lot on this channel. Again, lots of individual little essays on individual little topics. But for example, quite a few classic anti-FDR essays in there. Walter Williams crops up a few times. Just a great collection of things just mowing down all of the typical talking points of the left one by one by one, using econ for the most part. Now, Nassim Nicholas Taleb, as I'm sure many people know, has become a massive wazzock on Twitter, like an absolute idiot, I would say. But that doesn't mean he never wrote any good books. And Anti-Fragile, Things That Gain from Disorder, that's a concept that a lot of people use all the time now. I think Taleb possibly was the person responsible for injecting that into the general discourse. And it's the basic idea of anti-fragility is a good thing. Like, you've got to allow things to fail in order for things to become stronger. So when a shop closes down, or when a restaurant closes down, we don't automatically say there's been a crisis in the restaurant industry, right? We just see that as a normal part of the market process, or at least we did before COVID. I mean, the pandemic is kind of not economics as normal, which is what some people have been asking me, like, what I make of what's happening with central banks and so on. I have no idea, because we're off the map. Since the pandemic started, we are off the reservation as far as I'm concerned. All normal rules seem to be suspended. I can't even pretend to understand how the economy is not collapsing, or why we don't have massive inflation. Both of those things seem like they should be coming soon to me. But what do I know? Anyway, Anti-Fragile is a very good book. And again, he talks in a very useful way about the Soviet Harvard system, where it's like these Harvard professors who are, these Keynesian professors want to create a world without any risk. And in fact, the pandemic is a pretty good example of how they're trying to create a risk-free world. He's talking about the banking sector. You've got to allow financial institutions to be able to fail. There's got to be anti-fragility in the system, because otherwise, you have to patch it up more and more and more, and you're on the road to serfdom already. I guess it's the point that Mises is makes as well. You start making this concession and that concession, and step by step, before you know it, you're in a total state. By which I mean the totalitarian state. And look at what's happened in this country. I've said it before, the NHS eventually will just account for the economy. And that's what's happened. Save the NHS, not save life, help, not help the NHS, like save the NHS, like say, sacrifice yourself to save the health system. That's what's happened in this country during the pandemic. I mean, interesting, isn't it? Anyway, Mark Thornton, The Skyscraper Curse, another really good book on the financial crisis, shows that just before any financial crisis, you get a kind of epidemic of people like trying to build like the tallest building in the world. Some good stuff there. And absolutely classic study, Veteran Galloway, Out of Work, basically the book to show the catastrophe of the New Deal and FDR just didn't work, and they've got the numbers to show it, month by month by month. So that's a great study, Out of Work. Now, economic history. And what have I listed here? So the Not-So-Wild-Wild West, Property Rights on the Frontier. again, one of the more counterintuitive books you'll ever read, but I really like it because you've got the idea of the Wild West as this lawless place, of this place without outlaws and bank robbers and bandits, and they show the real story of it being not like that at all. You know, low murder rate, low crime, and they say like the reason is because everybody had a gun, and so property rights were strongly defended. You know, there were less than 40 bank robberies in 100 years or something. So, yeah, pretty good counterintuitive econ study. I mean, economics is always at its best when it overturns some bit of kind of received wisdom that you've got. The Broadbury book, British Economic Growth from 1270 to 1870. This is just a book of stats, but I love these crusty Cambridge books of data. They just make me happy. And anybody who's a longtime viewer of this channel knows that I frequently go to these books of data to pull out, you know, whatever stat it happens to be. I leaned on this book extensively, for example, in my recent video on 1381 John Smith versus his 19th century counterpart. So, yes, just checking that my mic is still working. Henry George is not on the list. No, it's no George's, get out of it. Edwin Canan has got another great study here. Now that I look at it, Canan, oh no, because that was Jevons. History of local rates in England in relation to the proper distribution of the burden of taxation. That's a really dusty study of tax rates in English history, which sounds really dull, doesn't it? But it's not. It really isn't. Looking at the burden of taxation over time. Do you think we get taxed more now than they did in the 19th century? The answer is yes. Do you think they got taxed more in the 19th century than they did in the 18th? The answer is yes. In fact, taxation has gone up and up rather than vice versa. It's just that they used to tax stuff more. So like people will know about the window tax and the candle tax and all this sort of stuff. Whereas after a certain time in history, I'm trying to remember who it was who brought it in. Was it Wellington? They brought in the income tax. You know, and they said, oh, well, initially they said, oh, well, the income tax will only be for the very wealthy. And then actually it ended up being everybody, didn't it? So, so the history of tax is an interesting question. And the tax burden's actually gone up and up across the board, like not just for the rich, even like the McDonald's worker probably pays more tax now than his equivalent would have done like in 1600, say. Another one of these epic books of data is the Dean and Cole British Economic Growth 1688 to 1959. I never tire of going back to that. That one featured extensively in my video. Do you remember my video against D, the Won't Somebody Think of the Children, where I was arguing that many of these kids would have been better off being able to work down the mines rather than you know, being forced not to. It was the Dean and Cole data that I used in that video. Floyd and McCluskey's Economic History of Britain since 1700. This is my 3-volume Cambridge stuff. This is good. I don't know if anybody remembers my video on does India owe 45? Does Britain owe $45 trillion to India? That was the book that I got all of my kind of empire data from. You know, the fact that the empire, for every pound the empire made, it gave £2 back. You know, so the empire cost Britain, you know, almost double what it brought in. So, in fact, the the economic data of the empire is a whole subject in and of itself. And I may return to it because there are many great and interesting facts in this three-volume economic history of Britain that I could pull out that people would be surprised to learn about, given the leftist view of history that you get taught, everywhere now. For example, looking at the wage rates of India, I think I did that in that video on whether Britain owes India any money. Looking at the average wage of just a normal labourer in India, for example, from 1800 to 1950, etc. Okay, Burton Folsom Jr., The Myth of the Robber Barons, another good book. If you're interested in the Robber Barons, that's a good book to read, but I will always send people back to those Rothbard lectures on the Robber Barons, because genuinely interesting part of American history that. Find those on YouTube somewhere. Robert Higgs, Crisis and Leviathan, absolutely classic study, where he points out that never let a good crisis go to waste, basically, and the forces of Leviathan will always use that to the advantage. And again, we're living through an example. In fact, we've lived through several examples in the past year. They were never going to let the pandemic go to waste as a good crisis, were they, to push through things that they wanted. And the same is true to a lesser extent of what happened, with the storming of the Capitol last year. They were always going to try to use that situation to their advantage to reinforce their power. And Higgs shows basically that's been a consistent pattern all through American history. Oh, the history of any country, really. Another great study, Guido Holzmann's The Ethics of Money Production. Basically, this is a kind of distillation of Mises's theory of money and credit. But I think that's a slog. It is on the list later on, spoilers, but... I think that's a slog, and I think The Ethics of Money Production is a kind of much easier book to read. And it's also just nice bits of history of money stuff in there, stuff about, when they had the tablets of leather for credit in the certain period, and how paper money came into existence, and all sorts of different things. So that's a very good money book, the Holzmann one. Of course, he's arguing for return to the gold standard ultimately, but, by the by. B.R. Mitchell's Economic Development of the Coal Industry, 1800 to 1904, is another one of those dry as dust Cambridge studies that kind of make me happy. I think I used that one in the Won't Somebody Think of the Children video as well. I don't know, I just like the feel of those old data. It's just a book of data, but looking at the industrial output of coal makes you realize that the coal industry in Britain basically had about an 80 to 90 year decline. It was in decline from about 1880, as far as I can tell. And then British Historical Statistics is also by B.R. Mitchell, an absolute master of the genre. And that's another book that I've mined for data points in many, many videos. In fact, those four books, the Broadbury one, Dean and Cole, and the Mitchell one, I find myself coming back to them all the time as reference points, for all sorts of different things. And then... finally, 40 Centuries of Wage and Price Controls by Eamon Butler and Robert Schettinger. It's only a thin book. It seems like that would be a very thick study, right? But it's actually quite thin. Just an interesting kind of look at all of the many of the failed attempts to implement price controls through history and how they invariably lead to inflation. And I think I went to that a few times in my Econ Shot series as well, because a bit like the antitrust book, it's got lots of nice little vignettes that I plundered for videos in the past. If more people had watched Econ Shots, I would have made more, but you know, sometimes the market's wrong, folks. The market didn't like Econ Shots, so I stopped making them. All right. Hopefully people can still hear me. I'm always worried that my mic is going off, but people can still see me. Somebody in the chat, D. Bruce, is saying land is not capital because it cannot be produced. That's right. Land has to be treated differently from capital. It's not. It's strictly speaking, its own category, and Rothbard discusses that at length in Man, Economy, and State, among other places. Now onto the history of economics. So, I mean, this is pretty special interest stuff, I would say. This section, like, you have to be pretty into econ to start getting into, like, what's the history of the theories. But again, Kanaan crops up with a history of the theories of production and distribution, where he basically goes through, like, I think he even starts like with Aristotle, you know, and goes through like how did each successive generation of thinkers think about production and distribution. Absolutely fantastic piece of and he's got some amazing phrases, Kanaan. I'm pretty sure it's in that book where he says, you know, what does he say? Like, you know, what does he say? Got just a great phrase in there. I just have to get it up. I'm just going to look up this phrase because I want to get it right. It's from that production book where he's criticizing on Stuart Mill. One of the things I like about Kanaan is that, and Jevons, in fact, is that they have a kind of raging hate boner for John Stuart Mill. And I appreciate that because I also have a raging hate boner for John Stuart Mill. So, talk about people who are bad at econ. Mill is definitely one of them. Let's have a look at if I can find this phrase. Hold on. So this is Kanaan. He says, however lucky error may be for a time, truth keeps the bank and wins in the long run. I've always loved that phrase from Kanaan ever since I came across it. You think these studies will be as dry as dust, and then, you know, you're hit with phrases like that. Let us carry on. I found when I was trying to learn about the 18th century kind of scene that this chap Peter Groenewegen, this was a very good book. Steve Cates is, if you ever want to know anything about Say's Law at all, that Steve Cates book is the final word. Now that Lord Keynes 2 has been banned from Twitter, I doubt I will ever touch the topic of Say's Law again. But it was one of the things that Lord Keynes 2 loved to try to rail on, was Say's Law. And Cates is your one-stop shop. I mean, Thomas Sowell wrote a good book about Say's Law, as did W.H. Hutt, but I think they're probably superseded by the Cates book. And then, as I mentioned, the absolute master of this genre, the history of econ, is Schumpeter. Schumpeter, I mean, he was like a kind of Tolstoy of economists, I guess, like a kind of someone who was just able to really like just give his view on vast swathes of literature. So Schumpeter Both of his histories here are well worth tracking down, especially if you want to get into the nitty gritty of, you know, exactly who made which developments when. So yeah, Schumpeter's great for that. And then on the question of Austrian school versus Chicago school, Mark Skousen's Vienna and Chicago, Friends or Foe, A Tale of Two Schools, A Free Market Econ, is a pretty good history of both of them, their agreements, their disagreements, what he thinks is good, what he thinks is not good, etc. Okay. Now on to the individual authors, and Henry Hazlitt, one of the titans of the 20th century, on the free market side of things. He, obviously, everybody knows Economics in One Lesson. I still say the best introductory book on economics, probably. You know, if I'm just going to recommend one book, nobody's ever read any econ before, Hazlitt is probably the way in, because it's short. He uses, you know, it's got that lovely, crunchy, the real world, you know, you can feel the real world in it, which I think the best econ books must have. You know, I mean, maybe some of his examples are a bit kind of specific to the 40s and the 50s now. Like, we probably don't think in terms of like massive infrastructure and bridge building and so on so much anymore. But they're still applicable. And, you know, what it is really is a book length treatment of that Bastiat idea of what is seen and what is unseen. But, you know, tremendous book. But then he's got some other stuff that people talk about less, but no less brilliant. The Failure of the New Economics is like almost like a line by line takedown of Keynes's general theory. Again, very handy for the days when I was arguing with Lord Keynes, because usually I could just go to that book and be like, yeah, Hazlitt's pointed out why this is wrong right here. The Wisdom of Henry Hazlitt is like a collection of essays and things by him. And another really kind of hidden gem is Business Tides. I think every week for almost 30 years, Hazlitt wrote a column in Newsweek. And they're collected in this book that the Mises Institute put out called Business Tides. And again, when I was doing the econ shots, that was another of my key sources. I tended to rotate between the antitrust book, that one by Eamon Butler about the, you know, 50,000 years of price controls. And then I just kind of pick a random date in Business Tides and be like, well, what was Henry Hazlitt moaning about in 1952? Oh, right. Oh, that's interesting. And I learned a lot of forgotten stuff reading through some of those essays by Hazlitt, like, you know, the fact that the 1960 JFK Nixon election was pretty much a fight over who was going to give more subsidies to farmers, for example, you know, just stuff like that. So yeah, Hazlitt, fantastic. And then Hayek, he actually got all five of his in, but my picks are not the picks. Like, I haven't picked Road to Serfdom or, you know, his political books. So obviously, I have picked Individualism and Economic Order, which is a collection of essays, but a lot of his most important ones are in there. Studies in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics. That also has, like, whatever important essays he wrote that aren't in Individualism and Economic Order are in that second book. Then 1980s Unemployment and the Unions is if you've got a particular interest in that topic, he basically goes through how the unions were ultimately to blame for the unemployment epidemic that swept across Britain in the late 70s and the early 80s, for which Margaret Thatcher was blamed, of course, but ultimately unions were the source of that. And that book was kind of influential on my thinking. You know, a lot of people, I mean, everybody's got their own story of how they found my channel, but I know a lot of people came through the video that I made on unions. And probably Hayek, that book by Hayek was part of my, you know, part of my thinking there. Yes. Now, this is to say nothing of Hayek as a political thinker or as a classical liberal or anything. This is just Hayek, the economist, okay? The trend of economic thinking, essays on political economists and economic history, that's a real, like, Hayek wrote about all sorts of things. And among other things, he was very good on the history of economics. So when I was writing my book, I found that Hayek was often somebody to go back to. Be like, oh, Hayek was reading Cantillon and he found all sorts of good things in him. Hayek was reading Turgot. I mean, so he was a fantastic kind of intellectual guide through a lot of those things. Yeah, he did a lot more of that sort of work than you'd imagine Hayek, and they're just kind of hidden in his back catalogue, as it were. Everybody goes to the big hitters like Surf, you know, Road to Serfdom or Constitution of Liberty, and all of this, you know, lesser known stuff kind of falls by the wayside. But to me, it's of more value, really. And then finally, Business Cycles Part 1 is actually a collection of two books. It's got Prices and Production in there, which for me is, I mean, a very good book on why Keynesian interventions into, it's actually not, to be fair, it's not Keynesian. It's some guys who came before Keynes, but he basically shows why government investment in production on the producer side or on the consumer side aren't actually going to work in the long run using just kind of pure logic. And you see some of the famous Hayekian triangles in there as well. So, yeah, Business Cycles Part 1 is good. But some of the other essays included in there are good as well. One of the things with Hayek is that, unlike Mises, it was kind of on his own island for a lot of his career. Just, you know, floating around giving speeches and writing massive books, etc. Hayek spends a lot more time kind of just arguing, you know, writing scathing reviews of Keynes or arguing with long forgotten economists of the period. And you learn a great deal from Hayek's kind of engagement in the academic debates of the period. And I think that's because for a lot of that time, he was in and around London School of Economics. So he was kind of in a department working with Lionel Robbins. And so there's a lot more of that kind of general stuff from Hayek somebody's saying that Hayek book about unions goes for £80 on Amazon. I'm pretty sure my copy didn't cost that much. How much did I get? I must have paid less than that. I can probably tell you how much I paid for it. Shall I have a look? Tiny as well, tiny little book. I bought my copy for £8.84. So if you search long and hard enough, folks, you can find one for less than a tenner. Don't pay £80 for it. All right, so carrying on. Now the guy I go to a lot, W.H. Hutt, South African. I mean, he was actually English, but I think he worked in South Africa for a lot of his career. He's got a lot of great books, The Theory of Collective Bargaining, The Economics of the Color Bars, about how ultimately unions were behind apartheid, or apartheid was brought about to appease labor disputes between white and black workers. His book on Say's Law, which I mentioned. But for me, the standout out of these four is The Theory of Idle Resources, which is a again, a BTFO of many Keynesian sacred cows. He wrote it, look, all the way back in 1939, sadly ignored by most of the economics profession. He's just using pure logic again and asking, like, well, what do they mean by idle resources? Why are you looking to get full employment in the economy? Is that a good thing? A lot of common sense by Hutt, but much needed common sense thinking against the onslaught of Keynesian nonsense. So Hutt for me is one of the great underrated economists of the 20th century. And again, you know, someone like Lord Keynes too, he just kind of scoffs at Hutt, you know, calls him names and things, which is usually a good sign that he was onto something. Then there's the man himself, of course, Ludwig von Mises. He obviously gets all five. I think people will be more interested in which ones I've picked. Obviously, Human Action is there. Epistemological Problems of Economics is a very interesting book on method, writing about method. Like, why does he use a priori reasoning as opposed to, you know, empiricism or positivism like some of the other guys? And he goes into detail there on that. I will say, though, a possibly easier book to read, I forgot to mention this, was all the way back here by Hopper. That book by Hopper, Economic Science and the Austrian Method. You can find it on the Mises Institute. I think it's there for free. If not, you can probably track down a copy reasonably cheap on Amazon. That, I think, does a kind of job of making Mises a bit more digestible on this issue. But Mises writes pretty well as well, to be fair to him. So, Mises on epistemological questions is always interesting, because it kind of, if nothing else, it shows you some of the intellectual poverty, the philosophical poverty within the economics profession. So one of the great disappointments for me is when I was reading like Friedman or Stigler or some of these guys, is like they just don't have a mind to ask those sorts of questions. It's just kind of, they're maths guys. Like they can't ask those questions for some reason, much to their detriment. Then what else? Yeah, Socialism, an Economic and Sociological Analysis. I mean, that is not just Mises kind of saying like socialism sucks, guys. He does a full kind of economic mental experiment. He says, imagine there were no prices. Imagine you were living in the sort of economy that is described by the socialists. Like, imagine they got all of their own way and everything was planned. What would that economy even look like and how would it function? That's what he does in Socialism, which is an absolutely classic study. It's based on there was an article in 1920, and which he then expanded all the way out into this book. There's a little bit too much kind of like random bits of sociology and stuff in there for my tastes. But the economic sections of that are absolutely fantastic. Theory of Money and Credit, which we talked about, kind of lesser known book by Mises, or at least I don't see it being discussed that often, is the collection of kind of speeches and essays called Planning for Freedom. Now, do you remember when I was talking about milkman nationalism, like, you know, up the milkman? Oh, we were talking about Trump done. I was trying to imagine, like, how could we get this kind of lovely feel of the 1950s town that we're talking about? It was really the world that is described in some of these speeches that Mises gives in Planning for Freedom. You know, in fact, he has a whole section just on milk. He's like, imagine you start to try to bring price controls on milk. What will happen across the economy there? But I just like to imagine, you know, I remember at one point we had like a Mises as a milkman, as a meme, stuff like that. It was from that book, Planning for Freedom, that I got some of that stuff. So, yeah. Mises, the master. Now, Lionel Robbins, some economic students may have heard of him because of, the definition of economics that people typically have, you know, the allocation of scarce resources which have alternative uses, some people say the allocation of scarce means that have alternative ends, right? It was Robbins who came up with that in his classic, An Essay on the Nature and Significance of Economic Science. But beyond that, that is an absolutely brilliant book. And it's a brilliant book because Robbins stresses time and time again in there the impossibility of calculating social utility, which a lot of the subsequent, like Chicago guys, seem to forget. Like some of the stuff that Robbins talks about in that book is so common sense and so obvious. I don't understand how, like, the economics profession was able to get to a point where it forgot all of the things that he was saying there. And even more disappointingly, like, Robbins himself later on in his career kind of had a bit of a Keynesian turn, and I don't understand that, because he laid out reasons why you shouldn't do that in that book in 1932. I can only say it's the kind of, he must have desired like social acceptability or something like that, which is all humans do, but as someone who's just immune to the, like, I don't care about that. I'm much, much more interested in the truth than I am about social acceptability. It's a bit disappointing that Robbins did that later in his career. But he wrote more. Like, I've got five books by Robbins here. So what are some of the others? Well, as it turns out, the other person, apart from Schumpeter, who is an absolutely amazing historian of economics itself, is Lionel Robbins. Lionel Robbins probably read more economics than any person ever to live, I reckon. He knew everything. He seemed to have read everybody. So that's, you know, when I was writing my stuff and researching my stuff, Robbins was an absolutely invaluable source. I mean, I don't know how many references in my book there are to Robbins, but I'd imagine, like, it must be double figures. There must be, like, at least 20, 30 references to Robbins in the book. I mean, somebody will have to check. Now, one thing I will mention is that some of the, I think one of these books, I can't remember exactly which one of these it is. Yes, it's The History of Economic Thought, the LSE lectures, is literally a collection of Robbins's lectures. And there's something about the way they're written where you can just imagine him standing there, you know, with a chalkboard, with, you know, like, as you'd imagine the students to have been, like, back in the 40s and the 50s or the 1930s even, when he was teaching. And I don't know, there was something exciting, like, I don't know, it made me think of a time when possibly universities were exciting, where you could have, like, a genuinely inspiring person to teach you, like Robbins would have been back then. But what was interesting, like, as someone who's given many lectures myself, I saw so many of his tricks. Like, there are so many lecturer tricks. And it's just so funny to see Robbins, like, do those tricks. Like, I could tell, you know, that's his little icebreaker joke for lecture one to, you know, bring in the new. There were so many little things that he did in there that I appreciated, you know, as someone who's been a lecturer. But also, there are times in there where he gets on his soapbox a bit and starts moralizing. So he has kind of little bits where he wants to, like, sympathize for the plight of the working man, and he's like, oh, you know, what do you do when people are starving and things like this. So there are kind of elements of Robbins which are, he's not exactly a thoroughgoing free marketer, but a great economist nonetheless. Now there's Murray Rothbard, and he also has all five, of course. And you know, man, economy, and state is absolutely fundamental. You know, second only to human action, really, in terms of its utility as a textbook. I think if any of you do Foundations of Economics, you'll see that human action is the core text, but it has, let's just say, huge backup from Man, Economy, and State. Those are the two. He wrote Man, Economy, and State nominally as a kind of guide to human action, or as a way of helping to make sense of human action type thing. But it really is a masterpiece in its own right. Rothbard was I don't want to say he was the greatest economic historian, but he's got to be up there. And America's Great Depression, again, is a masterpiece. I really like The Mystery of Banking, which I always recommend to people. On the history of economics, I was saying Hayek, An Austrian Perspective on the History of Economic Thought, again, invaluable. I must have referenced that about 20 times throughout the book as well, because it seems that Rothbard has read everybody too. And it was very useful to me when I was reading Say, or I was reading Turgot, and I was saying, like, hold on, hasn't Turgot got everything right? Like, what, this all seems correct. What's he got wrong? And you'd go to Rothbard and you're like, oh, of course, you missed that. Or, yeah, yeah. So it's really, really useful to have Rothbard as a guide through some of those older. So that is a masterpiece as well. An Austrian Perspective on the History of Economic Thought. And then another book I've come back to time and time again is Economic Controversies, where Man, Economy, and State is like a textbook. And a lot of the other Rothbard collections are kind of like his, you know, random articles for this libertarian journal, or newspaper newsletters he was writing, or random movie reviews, or Lou Rockwell articles and things like that. And all of those are good and fine. But the Economic Controversies collects his academic economics, which is a whole different beast. And it's really good. It's engaging. And it answers a lot of difficult questions that aren't answered in Man, Economy, and State. Or it clarifies things that you don't quite understand. There's a whole bit in Economic Controversies where he talks about the difference between the a priori basis for his system and the a priori basis for Mises' system. And you're like, hold on, what? They don't have the same basis? Like, Rothbard was meant to be the disciple of Mises. How could they possibly have a different foundation? But they do. They do have a different foundation. Mises has a kind of almost like Kantian start to his way of thinking, or a phenomenological basis, you could say, whereas Rothbard has a kind of empirical base, like almost like a Thomist basis to his. That blew my mind when I read that. I couldn't believe it, and it took me about a week to come to terms with the fact that these guys agreed on everything, and yet the basis of their entire system is like the underlying first axiom is built from a different place. So that's, you know, it's just stuff like that in general. Economic Controversies is the place where he talks about psychic profit, something we've talked about a lot on this channel. It's an economic controversy. So that's another one that I can't recommend highly enough. So in fact, all of these Rothbard books are really good. And he's got many others too, but I really rate Rothbard the economist. And I think that, how can I put this? I don't want to annoy anyone, but I think it's fair to say that Rothbard the libertarian, or Rothbard the political philosopher, comes to overshadow Rothbard the economist a little bit. And I think that's a bit of a shame that happens, because he's got many searing insights in these books. And all anybody can think about is, oh yeah, but didn't he say once that you could, you know, sell your child into slavery? Who cares? Anyway, that's just me. I was always more on the econ side than the kind of ANCAP side, I guess, if that makes any sense. Thomas Sowell, I'll never tire of Shilling Knowledge and Decisions. Absolutely fantastic application of the Hayekian knowledge problem to every aspect of life. But also, I think it does a very good job of explaining why we're facing so many of the problems with institutional capture that we are now. Like, why are all these institutions leftist and, you know, against us? Like, why is there nobody on our side? And Knowledge and Decisions, I think, gives the answer. Basic economics, of course. You know, I always say, if anybody wants to get into econ, step one, Hazlitt, economics in one lesson. If that floats your boat, step two is basic economics, and that should, like, secure the deal. I mean, it's just a very good way of bringing economics home to things that you can relate to, you know, stuff in the shops, petrol, you know, petrol stations, cars, you know, it's just really good outline of basic price theory across the real world. I still remember almost all of his examples. Like, the one I'll never forget is when he talks about White Castle and how the McDonald's franchise system came to overtake the centrally managed White Castle in the fast food biz. I love that one. And also when he talks about AMP stores, is it the AMP discount kind of catalog, and how kind of the modern mall overtakes AMP. That's another one that seems to stand out. So I love all of that stuff. Affirmative action around the world, an empirical study, sadly ignored, but shows that affirmative action never works, always creates resentment, never has the effect on the desired group. And one of the best things he does in that study is that he doesn't just stay in the US. He shows it in India, shows it in Malaysia, shows it in all sorts of places. Housing boom and bust, about the 2008 crisis. Loads of great hidden details in there about HUD and, you know, shenanigans in the 90s and, you know, stuff that the Clinton Foundation was into and stuff like that. But also, just like the basic lessons of supply and demand applied to land, you know, land use restriction laws. You know, how is it that land in Houston, in Texas, has gone up, you know, 10 times more slowly than land in California? And then discriminations and disparities, I think, is, you know, I could have picked any of Sowell stuff on race and economics, but I think discriminations and disparities, which came out like what, a couple of years ago, sums up a lot of the stuff he's talked about for years in one nice little kind of shot. So Sowell's mentor, his PhD supervisor, was George Stigler. And like I said, theory of price is really what basic economics is built on top of. Stigler was a Chicago economist rather than a Austrian economist, of course. I will say Stigler's a pretty dry writer. But he does do some lovely, crunchy, data-driven analysis at times. You know, that book on production distribution theories across the, you know, he looks at, that's a kind of history of economics type book. So yeah, Stigler is another one who wrote a lot about the history of econ, but I like some of his stuff on like wage rates and price, like actual real world prices data and stuff like that. You know, what is the point at which economies of scale stop working? What is the point at which it's advantageous to remain a medium firm as opposed to becoming a large firm? All those sorts of questions are questions that Stigler tackles in some of his empirical studies. So, well worth a read. And you can say whatever you want about Chicago School. Stigler, I think, was an honest economist who did some good, strong work in the, you know, in the 50s and the 60s and in the 40s. Okay, so let's carry on. So we are now, it is now time, folks, drum roll for the top 10. So number 10 is, should I do like a kind of countdown? 10 is Guido Holzmann's The Ethics of Money Production. Like I said, a very good book on money, and my pick for 10. I wonder if my channel's big enough for them to like put that on the front, you know, top academic agent, top 10 pick for econ. He could put that on the back, you know. James M. Buchanan's, I met Guido, by the way, and he's a thoroughly nice chap as well. James M. Buchanan, Cost and Choice. Like I said, probably the best book that will ever be written on cost. Short, Ethics of Money Production, short, Cost and Choice, short, Theory of Idle Resources by W.H. Hutt, short. That, you know, that's always welcome when a book is not that long, because you can probably get through it in a couple of sittings, you know. Theory of Idle Resources, like I said, BTFO of Keynes, and basically the entire Keynesian system falls down once that idea of idle resources falls down. It's a total bloody nonsense, and Hutt shows you why it's a nonsense. And yet, look how it persists. Hayek, The Business Cycles, Part 1, as I mentioned, that's got the price. It's really prices and production, but I include this book as opposed to the prices and production because of the other stuff they include, you know, the ancillary essays and stuff, all really good. Kind of a macro book, but still excellent. Then Higgs, Crisis and Leviathan, as I mentioned. Olson, Logic of Collective Action, Never Tire of Shilling, either of those books. 4 is the Robbins book, Essay on the Nature and Significance of Economic Science. If nothing else, it's because Robbins is thinking from first principles, and he's thinking logically. That's why that's such a good one. And again, I wish, you know, I bet you anything in, you know, somebody was asking me if he should do an economics major. I imagine that if they even mentioned Robbins at all, it would literally just be a very quickly to say, oh yeah, he came up with this definition of economics. That's it. That's all you need to know. Move on. But I reckon they probably wouldn't even mention any of these guys at all. I've mentioned 100 books here. I'm wondering if you will encounter even one of them if you did a degree in econ. I doubt it. Honestly, I doubt it. They'll just give you like one textbook and just you say, this is economics. You learn this. Now do your models or whatever. Thomas Sowell, Knowledge and Decisions. Number 2 is Man, Economy and State. And number 1, of course, did anybody have any doubt? It's Human Action by Mises. All right. So that'll do. I mean, I will just very quick. This is a live stream. I've just remembered that. So I will double check the entropy. Oh, yeah. Jacob has left a little comment in entropy. He says, recommendation of The Invisible Hand, how market economies have emerged and declined since AD 500 by Baz Van Bavel. It's about an analysis of capitalism as a cyclical phenomenon on chapter 2 so far. Now, I haven't read that, but sounds pretty leftist to me. That name, Baz Van Bavel, rankles with me for some reason. Let me just double check that. I mean, I don't want to write off anyone without having read the book, but yeah, okay. Where have I come across that name, Baz Van Bavel? I feel like I've got a book by him somewhere. Maybe I don't. Maybe it's another Dutch guy I was thinking of. I've got a book here on evolution and economics. That's it, The Evolving Economy by Ulrich Witt. That's probably who I was confusing Van Bavel with. Yeah, but I haven't read the book, so I can't really comment, to be honest. And then just have a double check to see if any any super chats coming. I doubt there's been any super chats, to be honest, given how dry this topic was. But you know, just double check. Oh, there was a couple. Blue Lambo says, can you share the PDFs to this list and the previous one? As I mentioned at the start, Blue Lambo, unfortunately, the PDFs save metadata. This was brought to my attention, and I haven't found a way of removing that metadata, so that's pretty annoying. So until I do that, I cannot link out the PDF. And EC90 says, Lord Keynes 2 was banned from Twitter, lol, WTF. Yeah, there was a day where a pile of people were banned from Twitter, like loads and loads of accounts, and Lord Keynes 2 was one of them. Don't exactly know why. So there we go. Why am I running out of battery when it's plugged? Oh, hold on. So there we go. This was just a kind of one-off special Monday night stream, because somebody asked me to talk about MMT. I've done two videos on MMT, which still get comments every day. I mean, I don't know where that's been shared, but I get comments like every day or every other day from various leftists saying, oh, you know, this or that, or you're a loser and all this sort of stuff. Shut up. So you can go back and watch those two. There's a long stream we did on MMT, me and Radlib, and then there's a shorter treatment, just a kind of video that I did as well. So there we go. This was just a one-off. I'll be back tomorrow night, of course, for the usual unpopular opinions. I just wanted to, you know, get this out there and making this as a mean that I don't have to watch Meghan Markle. All right, now get out.